Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ed Ray, President of Oregon State University. And I'm very delighted to welcome you here to Oregon State. This is the CH2 Hill Center. And as you may know, this is built with alumni relations and support friends of the university. It's a combination of the alumni center, the fellow students in the school, we've got two auditoriums, and the Hilton Gardens.
Thank you.
facility work, and I know the governor feels very important, very strongly for higher education. I believe we all do, because we're all products of it in pretty many ways. So thank you for hosting us. I'd like to thank the Gail Alcorn, Jeff Mills, and all of the representatives of the university that have been so gracious in inviting us and hosting us. I'm representing Raiders, and I represent District 3, which is essentially Gilsky County, and I'd like to introduce the rest of the community and the starting of our end of the year.
Thank you.
Areas that are becoming more and more Institute for Air Energy Institute in Washington, D.C. Beckley United is the very coordinated U.S. commercial nuclear industries outreach to state and local elected officials to increase awareness and report the federal energy carbon policy priorities. Mr. McGarry joined PEI in 2004. Before that, he served 13 years as federal liaison in Washington for two Ohio governors, George Voinovich and Bob Taft. He also worked previously as a legislative assistant press secretary for U.S. Representative McEwen. Prior to working at Capitol Hill, McGarry was an executive speechwriter for Ameritech in Detroit. He also spent 3 years with the American Trucking Association, serving first in ATA's Department of Public Affairs, and then later as an assistant president as CEO. Mike is a journalism graduate of the Ohio State University of Columbus, and he and his wife Kathy and son Dallas reside in Annandale, Virginia. Mike, it's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson and members of the Committee on Environment and Land Use. My name is Mike McGarry. I'm from the Nuclear Energy Institute in Washington, D.C. NEI is a public policy organization representing more than 300 entities involved in the use of nuclear technology, including most commonly all utilities that operate commercial nuclear power plants, the uranium fuel cycle companies, plant architects and construction firms, many nuclear medicine and radiopharmaceutical companies, universities including Oregon State, and labor unions and law firms. NEI commends Chairman Anderson and the committee for convening today's hearing on energy resources for the future, and we commend Oregon State for hosting it. I'm honored to be with you, and you'll hear among some of the other distinguished panelists. This afternoon, I'll highlight a few things that I most want you to know about today's commercial nuclear industry in terms of its impact on electric generation, energy costs, and the environment, before taking a look at the future. It's a future that our industry is confident will include an expanded role for nuclear energy and a cleaner earth. In the United States today, nuclear energy is one of the workhorses of our electricity grid. I want to spend just a moment offering a snapshot of the size and scope of the industry today. This map shows the locations of the nation's 103 commercial nuclear power plants. Here's a quick look at the present U.S. fuel shares, with nuclear ranking second only to coal. Fewer than 10 years ago, today's plants are more reliable and produce more electricity. Nuclear energy powers one in five homes and businesses in the nation. That's 20%, which is about the same percentage of power supplied by nuclear in the early 1990s. This 20% fuel share has remained constant, even though total U.S. electric supply has increased by 25% in the last decade. The increase in output from nuclear power plants over the last 10 years is impressive, the equivalent of more than 18 1,000 megawatt power plants running at 90% capacity factor. The projected average capacity factor in 2004 for all plants exceeds 90%. This remains at record levels. Notably, just a few years back in the 1980s, capacity factors as low as 60% were considered good. Today, we come to expect exceptionally high capacity from these plants. Nuclear energy enjoys one key advantage from what other baseload sources of electricity, and that's cost. Nuclear energy's production costs are presently less than 2 cents per kilowatt hour, and nuclear is less expensive than coal, natural gas, or oil. Nuclear energy success story is one the industry seeks to replicate and perpetuate. It is achieved in part by relicensing existing plants, that they plan to license by the new regulatory commission for 4 years. Some are nearing the expiration of those licenses and seek to extend for 20 more years. A number of plans have begun the relicensing process in recent years, and others will follow. This summarizes our progress to date. 68 U.S. reactors have now either renewed their licenses, filed their formal applications, or indicated to the NRC that they intend to do so. The remaining 35 reactors have not yet declared because most of them are not yet old enough. We continue to believe that virtually all U.S. nuclear plants will renew their licenses and operate for an additional 20 years. Not long ago, the relicensing process was a novel concept. Today, there's a routine licensing action. 10 years from now, we believe the issuance of combined construction and operating licenses for new nuclear plants, which is a novel concept today, will be similarly routine. Relicensing is a valuable means for extending a plant's useful life. The industry actively employs other methods for reducing generating capacity from the existing plant fleet. One important way is through power upgrades. A power upgrade is achieved through installation of more efficient or sophisticated equipment in the non-reactor parts of the plant. The reactor itself does not change. These improvements allow the steam produced by the reactor to generate more electricity. Upgrades, which also require NRC approval, can improve a plant's capacity by up to 20%. The industry continues to see small but steady increases in generating capability, either through power upgrades or restart of shutdown nuclear capacity. There is a tremendous story unfolding in Northern Alabama at the Brown Spirit site. The Tennessee Valley Authority and its contractors deserve a lot of credit for their success in pursuing the restart of Brown Spirit Unit 1. This is a very complex project, fully as challenging as building a new nuclear plant. And I'm happy to say it is on schedule and within budget at the midpoint of the project. I want to leave this section on nuclear industry performance without mentioning our commitment to safety, because safety is central to everything we do. Companies that operate nuclear plants have created a working environment that is focused on safety. Their aim is to integrate this safety focus into the workplace culture. And this strategy is working. In terms of worker accidents, nuclear power plants are much safer places to work than other types of electric utilities or the manufacturing sector. Here's another depiction of our safety performance. This view of, quote, unusual events, unquote, reported to the NRC's office story. Back in 1989, American reactors reported nearly 200 of these events. But in time, we improved dramatically in this area. Although there was an increase from 2008 to 2003, most of these events can be attributed to, quote, pending bad weather, unquote, an occurrence that's understandably not within the control of plant operators. So what about electricity demand? Every policymaker must be aware of the various projected increases in demand for electricity, both here and worldwide, in the years ahead. Here's a U.S. government projection. On a world scale, the International Energy Agency predicts global demand will rise by about 60% over the next 25 years. Two-thirds of that increase will be from developing countries. Just think of demand will be energy available at
sources of renewables.
Environmental advantages of clean, emission-free nuclear energy supports its expansion in the energy mix of the 21st century. The U.S. government has maintained a voluntary carbon reduction program for the past decades. The Department of Energy has just released its latest numbers covering 2002, and nuclear plants accounted for the largest percentage of the carbon reductions recorded, 35% of them, or a total of 36 million metric tons. Nuclear power remains the nation's largest source of emission-free electricity, providing 72% of the country's non-emitting power. We are by far the United States' largest source of emission-free electricity. As you know, the United States has not ratified the Kyoto Treaty. Whether the nation's carbon reduction efforts are voluntary or not, nuclear energy is still the largest emission-free energy source in the United States. Just as it is in Germany, France, Japan, and elsewhere. Policymakers in all of these countries recognize that nuclear energy plays a critical role in providing emission-free energy and are encouraging greater reliance on it. The fact that nuclear energy is emission-free is certain to become increasingly important in the years ahead. The industry is working to gain greater recognition of its clean air status, which could provide leverage for the expansion of nuclear energy in the United States and elsewhere. And this fact is contributing to the rising interest in new U.S. nuclear plants. Nuclear energy's environmental benefits have won the industry support from many different quarters. Here is the founder of Greenpeace, Patrick Moore, who reported about 2 months ago. This next quote looks like any other boilerplate, but it comes from mainstream financial media and a cover story earlier this year. And it's not in my slides, but just yesterday, the New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof had a piece titled, "Nukes Are Green." It contained this quote, "For now, nuclear power is the only source that doesn't contribute to global warming and that can quickly become a mainstay of the grid." Our environmental benefits are a key foundation for the support we enjoy from the White House and from many members of Congress and other elected officials at the state and local level from both sides of the aisle across the country. This broad support is invaluable as the industry prepares to rise to the challenge of building new plants, hopefully in the next several years. We believe the industry is well positioned to respond to the need for new nuclear plants in the years ahead. We launched a long-term program several years ago designed to create a business model in which companies can build new plants when they need new baseline capacity. We recognized back then that there was a large amount of preliminary preparatory work that must be done before any company could actually order a new plant and start construction. We recognize that it would take a number of years to complete that preparatory work, and that we needed to get started if we wanted to be in a position to start building, even by 2010. The industry program is fundamentally a risk management exercise designed to identify the business issues and risks you might encounter and identify ways to manage or contain them. We have two major objectives: to eliminate uncertainty in the NRC licensing process, develop workable financing approaches. We have a new licensing process designed specifically to prevent the construction delays, licensing delays, and commissioning delays encountered with many of today's nuclear plants as they were being built. We used our past experience to identify weaknesses in the regulatory process and to correct them. Understand that past experience does not provide a meaningful perspective on either the schedule for or the cost of nuclear plants that will be built in the future. The new licensing system ensures that all major issues, design, safety, siting concerns, are settled upfront before a company starts building and making substantial investment. It is designed to allow public participation at the point in the process when it can be most effective, and to exclude frivolous intervention and to preclude repeated consideration of issues that have already been resolved. The industry is taking steps to demonstrate that it works as intended. These are the activities that have generated so much interest over the past year or so, and and rightly so, because they are tangible evidence of a systematic and well-considered industry commitment. Three companies have applied for on-site permits, which are being reviewed by the IRC. Two other companies have expressed interest in developing applications for early site permits. Two industry consortia are developing applications for construction and operating licenses. This work is being cost-shared with the U.S. Department of Energy. This work represents a large financial commitment in excess of $500 million by reactor suppliers and other companies, because the combined operating license application requires completion of all design and engineering, including site-specific details. A third consortium, led by the Tennessee Valley Authority, has received funding from the Department of Energy to study the feasibility of building a new nuclear plant at TVA's Belafonte site in South Thoreau, Alabama. These three groups include all the large generating companies in the United States, as well as reactor suppliers, engineering and consulting firms, and other nuclear operators from around the world. We believe the first nuclear projects will have overnight capital costs in the range of $1,400 to $1,500 per kilowatt. Most of the higher cost is associated with the one-time investment of $400 to $500 million in design and engineering necessary to secure design and safety approvals from the NRC. After these initial costs have been recovered, later, follow-on nuclear projects can be built at lower capital costs in the range of $1,000 to $1,200 per kilowatt. Debt and equity investors and corporate boards will require government investment in the first few points for several reasons: to offset the first-time design and engineering costs, to mitigate the risks associated with new nuclear plants. We will do everything possible to eliminate licensing uncertainty, but until we build the first few new plants, investors will inevitably perceive nuclear construction to be a higher-risk investment than some other form of generating capacity, and will require higher returns on the debt and equity capital invested in the first few plants. There are several combinations of tools and techniques that will stimulate construction of the next nuclear plants in the United States. The specific combination of financing tools and techniques will vary from company to company and from project to project, depending on such factors as project structure and regulatory status of the project. Some combination of loan guarantees, investment tax credits, production tax credits, accelerated depreciation, and for some companies, rate-based treatment will achieve the desired results. It is important to remember that the financing challenges apply to the first few plants in any series of capital-intensive baseload power plants. As capital costs decline, as investors gain confidence that the licensing process works as intended and is not an unpredictable risk, follow-on plants can be financed without the support necessary for the first few projects. The bottom line is new nuclear generating capacity at the overnight capital costs we expect to achieve will be fully competitive with the new advanced coal-fired systems and more economic than gas-fired combined cycle capacity at the natural gas prices we're going to be seeing in the near future. By the way, the estimate shown here for the coal-based system does not include the cost of carbon control and sequestration, should they be necessary. Most of the nuclear plants in this country use light water reactor technology, or some variation of it. This safe, proven technology has been under constant development and refinement for 40 years, resulting in a U.S. plant fleet consisting of many dozens of units that are each virtually one-of-a-kind custom design. The plants were designed and built at a time when regulatory requirements, licensing standards, and technology were rapidly evolving. And the plants did their jobs. Industry is now committed to developing more standardized, less customized designs that are safer and will significantly reduce construction, operating, and training costs. Three advanced reactor designs were approved between 1997 and 1999. Another new reactor design has recently received final design approval from the NRC, the last step before formal certification. week. But that only 250 megawatts, not the kind of big 1,000 to 1,500 megawatt designs that U.S. utilities would prefer to build at this time. At 250 megawatt, the unit makes sense for areas without electricity presently or without being part of a large grid. It's basically contemplated for areas in an application that wants to distribute the electricity consumed nearby. It has, I consider it's got every bit as much many safety engineering attributes built into it that we have and contemplate for our larger units here, but I mean, I have to pursue it more in the question and answer period. The next generation of clinics could include designs offering additional benefits such as large-scale water desalinization and enormous potential gift for areas where potable water is a constant concern. This can make life easier for people after in the third world but closer to home. And Gen 4 research may produce breakthroughs enabling us to construct plants that don't need to be placed near bodies of water, rivers, lakes, or shorelines for cooling purposes. The industry has ambitious plans for the future. Moving forward, new plans will require more than the support from elected officials, the scientific community, environmentalists, and Wall Street. Further progress will not be possible without solid public support. Our latest opinion polls conducted last fall show that favorability for nuclear energy has never been higher, 67%. And there are fewer people, 26%, who oppose it. The public support is not just abstract or theoretical either.
Research Center at the USC. A senior research associate with the New York College Technical Institute. That she builds all the research center in Irvine and in the bottom of that speakers group.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. We're going to shift gears just a little bit from Mr. McCreary's presentation. We've been talking about our technology focus almost exclusively on electricity, albeit with a huge potential for other sources. We're going to talk about fossil fuel. I'm sure each one of your offices, voicemails are full of Representative, what are you going to do about these high gas prices? Well, don't panic is my answer to that. First of all, don't panic. I'll show some slides later that today's record high prices are in fact not record high prices. Fossil fuels continue to play a role. They're kind of the quiet kid in the back that does his work and gets the job done. Fossil fuels can provide some energy supply and provide certain energy services that other technologies can provide. But what I want to leave you with today, perhaps most importantly, is keep your eye on the infrastructure. It's the infrastructure that causes all the problems. And it's the infrastructure that is always ignored. I'm from California, and I know we have yet had in this part of the deregulation scene in California. However, what I can tell them, do something about transmission. And what happened in California in 2000 was simply a function of not enough transmission. Not enough transmission lines to move electricity around, but also not enough transmission to move natural gas around. So keep your eye on the infrastructure. I'm here to tell you, California never had an energy crisis in 2000. We had a capacity crisis. And as you look at different technologies and the policies necessary to encourage or discourage one or the other, keep in mind the fundamental difference between capacity and energy. Senator, when we asked a question, or made a point earlier about the low price of nuclear, with all due respect, it is a low price. There's low price for nice, flat, all the time, electricity. Well, I don't have my air conditioner turned on at the same time as the chair, and as well as any other one going. Electric loads go up and down, and there's different technologies that fit that load profile. And while people can take care of base load, natural gas is the only newly developable resource for load to follow. I can run it great, but I don't know if we can find a new place to do that. Regardless of how concerned your constituents might be, don't panic. Don't react with alarm. There's a lot of alarmism going on right now with carbon-based energies. One that could be capable, and I'm here to tell you about, and I'll show you some information on that in a moment, that they're becoming scarce and they're going to become more expensive. There's also the Malthusian approach that greater population and richness in affluence will negatively impact the environment. I have some data to show that, at least historically, that's not been the case. In fact, in developing countries, their major environmental issue is serving energy needs in a de-technology way. They burn metal and firewood indoors, and the greatest mortality is from indoor air pollution. And a simple way to solve that is having quick burning dung and firewood inside the house and start cooking with some modern energy source. Contrary to popular belief, there is not scientific consensus on human-caused global warming. I refer you to the past president of the State Climatologists Association, Dr. Patrick Michaels from Virginia, who has looked at most of the climate. And I also refer you to the scientific background of the IPCC report, and you will find a clear distinction between the second half of the report and the policy summary. Be that as it may, we have some figures regarding total energy demand in the United States. Renewables represent about 6%. Oil is about 40%. That includes all uses, not just electricity, home heating, industrial use, etc. As well as the forecast out to about the year 2025, this is from the Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration. I believe it reports it was in the various charts earlier. I do have these slides available in larger format if you'd like copies sent to you here. I'll let John know or somehow you'd like to send it to you. Carbon dioxide emissions are an important aspect. And you'll see in red and blue there sort of what happens if these energy projections of the DOE actually come out. I'm sure you've heard from various academics and whatnot about the so-called Hubbert's peak, that petroleum production has peaked and it can only go downward. Well, Dr. Hubbert actually made four projections. One was for U.S. oil, U.S. natural gas, world oil, and world natural gas production. It was right one out of four times. Okay. You don't get a model of paper baseball, you get a hit one out of four times. In addition, the only reason he was right for U.S. production is we found cheaper sources. We found that you can lift a barrel of oil in Saudi Arabia for a few dollars, whereas in most parts of the U.S., at that time, it was over $6. So why would you drain for the U.S. first at $6 rather than using a cheaper source? The important thing to keep in mind here as well is that U.S. production, as it peaked and slowed down, was based upon certain technologies available at that time. There are advanced technologies available today that can extract a greater percentage of what they refer to as the oil in place. Okay? Imagine the oil down in the box. It's not a vessel. It's oil that's stuck to the box. One of the greatest uses of carbon dioxide is to inject it in those oil wells. We can extract 20-30% more oil from what has been considered a depleted resource. Okay. That's one form of carbon sequestration. The daily country talks about 1,800 dollars. He was not right, and the one time he was right, he was right for the wrong reason. What this all tells us is how do we think about resources? We have oil, resources, petroleum resources, coal, other types of petroleum-based resources, natural gas, the dirt that they can make to produce fuel out of, the waste of living, biomass fuels, etc. They are not resources until somebody has an idea about how to get them, how to use them, and how to make beneficial use of them. The wind is not a resource until somebody develops a turbine. Petroleum is not a resource until somebody figures out it's useful for more than just putting outside canoes. The soil in Australia that they extract nuclear fuel from is simply dirt until somebody figures out the whole process. Then humans can need those resources once human ingenuity figures out how to get our resources. We have more oil reserves today, proven reserves, than we did in 1944, even though we used a lot in between. Part of this is a result of better exploration. A large part is a result of better extraction technologies. 50 years ago, one could not conceive of drilling a horizontal well 4,000 feet deep. But, oil comes in layers, and some layers are getting some of the guts of it. Go down 4,000 feet, go horizontal, and all of a sudden your traction percentage and your traction efficiency is dramatically increased. As it turns out, the amount of proven reserves outpacing our consumptions. In terms of all hydrocarbons, whether it's on the natural gas, coal, as well as petroleum, price, call it $2, you want to take out the tax burden, because that's a significant portion of these authorized gas, it's different in California than more than in Arizona. But the average retail price of gasoline is about $2. Keep in mind as well, today's gasoline is a better product than in the past. It burns cleaner, it enables the more efficient cars to run. Well, it's a better product. So even though the price has more or less stayed about $2, the quality of the gasoline is much better. Natural gas prices, a lot of people are concerned about natural gas prices. Yeah, it's volatile. It goes up and down. This projection is from, again, the Energy Information Administration. The green line shows what they expect it to be in banger dollars, but I don't always know if energy people can forecast inflation all that well. If they could, they wouldn't be energy, they'd be in branch lines. So the red line shows what it might be in constant dollars. And if you move gas on $3, it goes up and goes down a little bit. The price is pretty different from constant. What causes the price volatility always comes back to the issue of the infrastructure. Some pipeline in New Mexico blows up. So the Pipeline Safety Commission says, well, turn the pressure down everywhere until it gets back. Well, that itself, the regulatory decision, caused as large a reduction in the delivery capacity to California as did the fact that one of the pipelines was not completed. It has to do with capacity and infrastructure. Part of the reason, a big part of the reason, I would say the major part of the reason for gasoline prices while it swings up and down is because there's not many refineries that are running full out, and they're simply experiencing what you as representatives and we as a good scientist experience all the time. It's called burnout. You can only do so much if you're running 24/7. We've got a little bit of capacity. If one refinery goes out anywhere, we're short. All right? And I think the price goes up as we move on. Today's heavy demand, I'm going to be a contrarian view. Today's heavy demand is really a good thing. The reason there's so much demand for petroleum today is because the world economy is growing, and it's growing gangbusters. A lot of it's in China, Indian side. I'm personally glad that their economy is growing. It gives us an opportunity to sell our goods and services somewhere. We may not be doing the total anymore, but we're doing something. We're probably doing a lot of it. If we can sell those things to the Chinese and we don't do anywhere else, that's fine. There's always a concern about the environmental impacts because the technology has improved. Allow the technology to improve across the fields as well. That is the most crucial policy that you can make, is allow fossil fuels to advance as well. I mentioned earlier that petroleum, fossil fuels, natural gas can do things and serve certain needs that other technologies can't. This is one example. This is real data from a real wind farm. And on the top, you'll see that the actual peak loads for the grid. Okay, as I mentioned, I've heard after my comments on the time. So demand is high as well. Demand is very high. Demand in the winter, Pacific Northwest is high, and summer is low. Becoming cooler very well with this particular wind farm's output. There's no wind there in the middle of the day when it's hot. When we need electricity. Well, that difference can be made up a lot of different ways. Most economically efficient with natural gas fired, low following facilities, either peakers or real wind. I suggest that you have a creative juggle with your energy. One is that don't get annoyed. Energy historically has always been made more comfortable and affordable, discounted for the time being with the private authority. Reliability is a paramount concern. And to the same extent, avoid taxpayers and consumer subsidies. Allow the technologies to compete and win on their environmental performance and their economic performance. What you folks should be concerned about and paying attention to is providing the infrastructure. The freeways, the broadband internet, all those things that government really has a good role for. Looking forward, this is pretty much the same picture that I showed earlier, but on a worldwide basis. Stay optimistic. There's no reason for panic. Fossil fuels are improving both in terms of availability and price and environmental effects. All fuels present challenges. Most attractive infrastructure or capacity, either upstream or downstream. For example, wind isn't necessarily the only electricity that's required. And fossil fuels are volatile. For that, I'm available for any questions or smiley marks or whatever.
Yes, thank you.
One of your presentations that I met here, I read that the presentation was 20% of nuclear energy for the total output. You were a chart showing that only 6%. What's the difference?
I believe, and correct me if I'm not sure you're sure. My chart has to do with total energy. This was all electricity.
Okay.
Now, you will also likely see similar charts for the smaller difference, focusing just on electricity. Those tend to be whether you're looking at energy or capacity. Excuse me. And by that I mean, if you're looking at the total megawatt hours generated, you will have a difference
to recognize both of the reports that were submitted on behalf of the Global Warming Advisory Committee and the Department of Energy, which was the primary author on the Global Energy Action Plan. So the good news is that a message will be coming out in a few days. I don't expect that there will be any specifics other than some general speaking points on those two reports and acknowledging the significance of the information that's provided in those reports. And then really that's all I can talk about in the details specific to what I'm
Thank you.
3.5 building out jet mall, they pushed out and do both extended and octane enhancer. Again, jet mall is 150 octane, also, so there's a lot on both extensions. A octane enhancement plus features, just for extending the jet mall supply of fuel, and also, of course, we use the octane fuels, and we call it gas, regular small fuel reduction, and the oxy fuel program for the carbon monoxide.
technology could transform our world, improving the environment, reducing our dependence on oil imports, and growing Oregon's economy. Texas may be the heart of oil country, but Oregon really can be the heart of new energy technology built on environmentally friendly energy production. After the prior representative who was here testifying, I represented oil and gas companies in Oregon, and probably one of the only lawyers who practice oil and gas law in Oregon. I just would like to point out, vis-a-vis fossil fuels, there is only one producing gas field in the Pacific Northwest. It's the Lewis Field. It is a natural gas field. There has been extensive oil and gas exploration throughout Oregon and Washington. I made a lot of money advising companies doing that, and they all came up with dry holes. So while fossil fuels undoubtedly will be with us as part of our energy economy for some time, they are not fuels that are available in the Pacific Northwest, with the exception of a very small field at NIST, which is very close to depletion at this point, and primarily valuable as a storage facility. So Oregon, in my view, can be the heart of a new energy economy. And what it takes to do that is the creation of an alliance, as Dr. Grady mentioned, between the business community, companies like Cascade Grain, university leaders, and state leaders to recruit and retain the top research talent and finance the research work to develop the breakthrough technologies that you're going to hear a little bit about today that could transform our energy future. The Oregon System of Higher Education has been working on renewable energy for some time under the leadership of the Academic Excellence and Economic Development Subcommittee of the Board, chaired by Kirby Dias. And although Glenn Montgomery didn't mention it, he and I are both on a steering committee for a project, an assessment project that's now underway, funded by the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, that's really trying to lay out a roadmap for innovation on sustainability and natural resources, and renewable energy is one of the identified opportunity areas. Today, what we're going to do is showcase some of the renewable energy research talent at Oregon State University. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that there are researchers at the University of Oregon, Portland State University, the Oregon Institute of Technology, and OSU's Cascades campus, who are all focusing in on the same area, but they don't happen to live in Corvallis, so we didn't try to enlist them this afternoon. But it really is absolutely no wonder that Senator Wyden recently asked the vice provost and vice presidents for research at the universities to identify for him where the opportunities were in this area, because he is very interested in creating a new multi-institutional center of excellence in renewable energy in Oregon, just like the Oregon Nanotechnology and Microtechnology Institute, Bonami. I think that as we've been working on this area, and I was told by your committee administrator that you really want to hear about more than biodiesel and biofuel, that we have a developing framework for talking about renewable energy, and the people here today are going to tell you more about virtually all of these areas. One is energy conversion technology, wind, tidal, wave, solar. Another is bioenergy production and processing, which includes biofuel, forest biomass, processing technology, and I love this, fermentative production of hydrogen from lignocellulose materials, and you can ask other people what that really means. The third area is hydrogen fuel cycle and fuel cell technologies. I'm not going to go through the breakdown there. I'll leave that to someone who can pronounce the words. And three more of the areas that we are not going to cover today in any detail at all, but portable distributed energy systems, which are very important, a significant new area, and that are being addressed as part of the Omami initiative, and solar cell advanced light source technologies, which are another thing that is being addressed at OSU College of Engineering's Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics Department is ranked 9th in the country. And we have one of the areas of excellence where we're top ranked nationally and internationally is actually in nuclear engineering. And when your first witness mentioned the research work on the Gen 4 technology for a new generation of nuclear reactors, Andrew Klein, who was the head of the department until about 3 months ago, was just recruited by Idaho National Laboratory to lead their research initiative on that Gen 4 technology. And Dr. Jose Reyes, who's the acting department chair, just returned from working for a year with the International Atomic Energy Association defining their research agenda. Our radiation center here at Oregon State is the place, not only in the United States, but in the world, addressing the next generation of nuclear plants because, as Dr. Ray pointed out to me, we actually have the capability in the radiation center to do scaled-down models of these plants and run them. So any of you who are interested in the nuclear technology questions, you can set up additional information for you with the radiation center if you want to pursue that. But today, I'm very pleased to have five colleagues with me, and we have some chair-shifting. In fact, I think we have started, and I'm going to introduce them all now, and they can introduce themselves as we go. Dr. Alan Wallace from the College of Engineering is going to address energy conversion technologies, specifically wave energy. David Happelman and Christine Kelly from the College of Engineering are going to address bioenergy production and processing. Dr. Roger Leary of the College of Ag Sciences and College of Engineering is going to address hydrogen cycle fuel cell technologies. And Dr. Jan Wong from the College of Agricultural Sciences is going to address the Sun Grant Initiative that Dr. Ray mentioned earlier. There's a packet of additional information that you should all have received. Jock Mills and Brandon Felstad from our government affairs staff put that together. And it includes, just as back page, information on the new energy center at Oregon State, which is going to replace our aging steam plant with a new state-of-the-art green building certified power generating facility that will create the heat and the electricity for our campus, a steam cogeneration plant that we hope to be building in the very near future. So we've got a lot of exciting things here going on, and as I know, it's really this connection between renewable energy, research capacity at the university, and economic development opportunities here in Lyman. With that, I'll turn it over to Alan Wallace.
And then I'm just going to bring the members of the Health Committee on the Environment. Good afternoon. My name is Alan Wallace, and I'm a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at Oregon State University. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk to you today. My testimony today relates to the work that my colleague had on drawing by currently pursuing with an interdisciplinary theme of both graduate and undergraduate students. There are similar names in here, and some of them have actually had enthusiasm accompanying this presentation today. And I'm sure they'll have a great time remarkable on all the errors they make. You can notice that they're all the ones with black eyes and pretty tails and not that dated by the years. For several years, Dr. Bonjolat and I have been pursuing mutual interest in investigating the possibility of extracting energy from the oceans. For many of these years, we pursued funding for this endeavor, but it wasn't until just over 2 years ago that we actually struck. And we obtained a grant from the National Science Foundation under the premise of looking into novel ways of harnessing they believe the combination of the ocean current conditions, the accessibility of those ocean current conditions to getting power back around, and also the good availability of strong electrical connections to the power grid, all made us the best site for this application. I mentioned that
the meter of the wave height, or the wave height is a wave crest, or anything like that. The wave crest is technically related to what the domestic demand might be. Typically, a limit of between 1 and 1.5 kilowatts per household on average is a typical number. So we can see that the amount of energy that's available to the building is very, very large. The funding that we have received from the National Science Foundation has recently been augmented by the funding from RNC and also from the Ranger Foundation. And with this funding, we are looking at novel ways of extracting energy in the form of electrical energy from the steam project that we experienced in the previous on the ocean surface. The device on the left hand is a system which was developed by a group of students and tested last year in both in our lab and also in the OHN Hinsdale Wave Research Tank. This device, when subject to the oscillating motion of the ocean, drives a set of magnets to a set of coils and produces electrical energy directly. This we think is a great advantage compared to other systems which are being pursued at this time, in that the conversion process is direct and doesn't absorb energy on the way to intermediate stages, which is high volumes of the magnets. The conversion of electrical energy is a very interesting academic as well as technical problem. And the work that we are doing here relates to converting this linear motion to rotary motion in the two other devices shown in the slide. The first one is a device that we believe is the first of its kind in the world, which is a funding magnet system for conversion of linear motion to rotary motion to drive conventional rotary generators. The second system shown on the right, it is a contactless system for transmitting power from the beaming buoy into a completely sealed self-contained generator package. It is a system magnetic forces are again employed, and by transmitting forces this way rather than by hydraulics or similar intermediate forces, we can provide a fully contactless system, the process should be capable of being installed in the ocean and work without maintenance. So indeed, the reliability, maintainability, and efficiency are the key points in our work. At this time, the United States doesn't have a commercial energy program. Although we are aware that the U.S. Navy is funding these two companies, two private companies, who we are working in this area. This contrasts to, say, in Europe, talking to the other folks who use the ocean for their livelihood to see if we are not going to be on their activities. There is belief that such an installation in fact will create an artificial reef off the coastline, so not 2 miles out where we're intending to locate this thing. And this artificial reef would in fact not be detrimental to the ocean life, but might in fact attract it. There is a strong suggestion that this would increase the fish population in the area, and one source of revenue, we think, once we've established the department, might be to sell fishing licenses to them. Thank you.
Next, we're going to have Dr. Hackerman and Dr. Kelly.
Okay. Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Dr. Hackerman and my colleague is Dr. Christine Kelly. We're both members of the faculty of the Ecology Department of Chemical Engineering. I don't have actually on the slide for you, and I was going to put it up here, and the policy text is a baton being passed from one type of energy source to another. We currently use resident energy sources in the United States and the nation that are stored energies, and we need to pass that baton to renewable energies. Our objectives today are threefold. We'd like to support the state of Oregon in its recognition of renewable energy opportunities. We'd like to repeat a bit on research at OSU in the renewable energy source called biofuels. And to seek your aid to enable OSU to deliver results for Oregon and the nation of the state. I'm going to be quick, and I hope someone will tell me if I go past 5 minutes, because I know we have a short time. Biofuels are the product of renewable raw materials. So, some of the sources are agricultural crops, wastes from agricultural crops, municipal rate wastes, and actually even forestry disease and retail wastes, for example. There is the conversion of these materials into fuel, so there's an interest. So, processing of these fuels and renewable materials is a very important factor in the economic viability of biofuels in general. While in this seminar, we're focusing on the college of engineering components, I would find out that this work is only accomplished by close joint collaboration between faculty and students within the entire university and partners in public and private sectors. I wish to point out that the College of Agricultural Sciences, the College of Science, and the College of Forestry are closely involved. In addition, the College of Liberal Arts and Education, for we also have to deal with and work with the human perceptions for acceptance and use of these forms of energy. We're going to emphasize our research work in this field to focus on technologies that can use renewable raw materials, as I mentioned, like natural crossbodies, for conversion to fuels. In addition, we focus the work on technologies that can be applied at on-home, small scale, and more cooperative scales, as well as at large scales. Many of the projects that we work with partnered with technology supported by the Oregon Nanosciences and Microtechnology Institute. In particular, the things that we're working on right now include bioreactors, microreactors, and nanomaterial based catalysts. Next, I'm going to focus briefly on one area because we don't have time to get all of them, and that's going to be the amount of biodiesel at OSU. There are major efforts in the college on process development to produce ethanol and hydrogen fuels, but we just don't have enough time today to give them all justice. We realize we need plenty more information on those. Plenty of really good work. Now, biodiesel is produced from biologically produced oils. Biologically produced oils are present in practically every organism. Now, the important ingredients are algae, seed crops, and the use of waste cleaning oils. of Science and Engineering. And then you see the company. There's a lot of sources of interest, and that has manifested itself in numerous requests to the basins of information, and as just one more example, this very public session. This is a further request from the Ocean Extension Services from farmers throughout the state. In addition, some members of Dr. Farmers are already producing seeds to use oil with the expectation that we'll be able to utilize these to make ground use. They have supplied us with unprocessed oil and material equipment for work here at our students. Students have also created something called the Biodiesel Initiative. It is focused solely on making biodiesel viable within this region. The students are participating in an EPA P3 grant, which is People, Prosperity, and the Planet. And in fact, they will be competing in May in Washington, D.C. for a grant that they received in September. I am the faculty advisor for that year. Lastly, a local oil company here in Cornell is already elected to pursue biodiesel at its facility. And they are believing that there's also such a facility in the beginning, and there's one in Portland. So it's starting to become around the area and interesting. In fact, in Bend, there's a new show once a week on biodiesel. Particular areas of interest for us and applicable to the other research areas, so I'm using some examples that you can put in the others, is the utilization of local raw materials to manufacture the product, all of the working for that very one of these products. Development of enzymatic processes to directly synthesize the products. The reason for enzymatic processes is that it reduces the total energy necessary to produce the fuels. A definition of seed crops compatible with the existing agriculture. We want to make sure that we don't cause an issue with the local agriculture when we introduce a new seed crop. And developing processes to make the waste streams into usable byproducts in the processes. I might point out that in the case of biofuels, all of the processes and products are completely usable. We do not have what is called waste. We don't have things that we store off. If you could just only use up all my time, and I'll call it really quickly here, but pointing out that just to give you a few of the entities that we find in this area, there's microreactor engineering, chemical reaction engineering, separation sciences, fermentation, metabolic and genetic engineering, supercritical process technology. I could go on and on with crop and soil sciences, direct cellular industrial biology, seed research and development, entrepreneurial business planning, and education extension service interactions, so we span pretty much the university and the things that work together. More information is provided in the brochure we provided for you. And here at Lawrence University, we're particularly well suited for this work. And we are glad to be more research and resources to seek bio-oriented solutions to the effective development of biomass and energy fuels. With that, and the administration, for its leadership, has encouraged us to push forward in these endeavors. We believe with that support of Oregon and Oregon State University can indeed be a leader in the development and implementation of techniques of utilization of biomass resources and skills. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Eckerman and Dr. Gallia. We have a tape that you presented in Salem here several weeks ago, and that is available. Personally, watching with very impressed with what you're doing, and the whole team for publicly. And that is available for the reviews to be able to bring you to see it. Thank you.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. My name is Roger Beagley. I'm associate professor in the OSU Department of Engineering. In the only world we've ever experienced, most energy needs are met by burning fossil fuels. Yet the first oil well was drilled less than 150 years ago. And if all of Earth's geologic history, 4.6 billion years, is put onto a one-year calendar, with one day equivalent to 12.6 million years, the first oil well was drilled just 1 second ago. And if we generously assume that oil will last another 150 years, combustion of the entire store of oil will have taken place in a mere 2 seconds, or 300 years, 3 seconds.
Clearly, we must begin to think in new ways. And with global energy expenditures currently about $30 trillion per year, that's 30 trillion, the economic stakes are very high. Imagine that we could create an ideal energy device, and then imagine what that device would be like. First, it would rely on renewable energy and be safe, clean, and economical. It would be constructed of plentiful, low-cost, and non-toxic materials, would avoid rare or toxic metals, would use innocuous feedstocks, and would create no harmful products. It would be operationally flexible, amenable to either modular or integrated, mobile or stationary configurations. It would include energy storage capability and could provide both heat and power, yet would operate at safe, low temperatures. And rather than using large centralized power plants requiring proximity to a fuel source and expensive and inefficient distribution systems, it could be located almost anywhere and could function in micro-power type configurations, as originally envisioned by Thomas Edison, or in advanced smart power systems. Water-based photobiological management energy systems can satisfy these requirements, and fortunately, we already know much about how to create them. A solar final hydrogen energy system will have three functional components: hydrogen production, hydrogen storage, and hydrogen conversion to electrical power. Hydrogen can be produced by biological catalysts, enzymes, using solar energy to split water and make hydrogen. Many species of bacteria and algae do this naturally. The biological catalysts will be contained in a support substance optimized for optical properties, as well as for gas and liquid transfer properties. Produced hydrogen will be fused into a close-coupled storage compartment with capacity to meet the shape or mark of hydrogen demand. Finally, hydrogen from the storage component will proceed on demand to a close-coupled fuel cell that will provide electrical power as needed. The entire unit will be sealed and will have an internal system to recycle oxygen produced in the hydrogen production component and water produced in the fuel cell. The device will have one input, sunlight, and two outputs, electricity and heat. The device will be extremely safe because it will be sealed, no hydrogen losses, highly integrated, little or no free hydrogen within the device, and it will operate at a relatively low temperature, about 50 to 60 degrees C. It will be manufacturable in a range of sizes to function in either mobile or stationary installations. Finally, it will use abundant, inexpensive materials, mainly carbon and silica, will rely on biologically synthesized catalysts, and will be economical to construct and environmentally safe. As I have said, we already know much about how to create such a device. For example, we know how organisms harvest solar energy and convert it to chemical energy. We know that cyanobacteria, for example, have evolved different light harvesting antennae, and that they can modify them to suit the intensity and wavelength of available light. We know how they make hydrogen, and we know many of the factors that affect the process. We know how to immobilize enzymes or organisms in a support material. We know much about how to store hydrogen, a research area that is being very actively pursued around the world. Finally, we know a great deal about how to convert hydrogen to electrical energy, and many devices already take advantage of this technology, both in stationary and in mobile arrangements. A multidisciplinary team of engineers and scientists, most of them here in Oregon, has been assembled, and with adequate support, we believe that a prototype device such as I described can be produced within 5 to 7 years. Oregon has the opportunity right now to take steps to become a world leader in this technology and to capture a significant portion of that $30 trillion per year market. We live at a historic time in which threats of global environmental degradation and dire social and economic inequities are converging with fantastic potential for scientific advances. This convergence of compelling needs and breakthrough potential, unprecedented in human history, provides opportunity. The time is right, the door is open. But if we don't act decisively and boldly, someone else will. The Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of rocks. Thank you very much.
And she with basically five grant-like institutions and programs that are involved in the Western region consists of the nine Western states and the Pacific, the Caribbean islands and territory. So we have a very large territory. We are also the most diverse of all of the regions in the same Sundance network. Right. on renewable energy and biomass, dropping my own sweet states and innovating advice research from programs and centers throughout the rest of the country. And it will coordinate integrated interdisciplinary projects. That's one of the main mandates for the legislation, that we integrate amongst education and outreach and research. So individual projects will be requested to deal with.
to do